session number 11214, rule 6.
Colonel Jourdan, Reel 6. We were talking about your time training the Americans as a cadre of the 6th Battalion. You were just a few officers. Now, from there, I believe you left, and this is when you joined the 5th Battalion, Connaught Rangers, who'd come over from Palestine or somewhere.
Yes. I say left, I think we were disbanded. We were the fag end of the 6th Battalion. And then as we were completely broken up, they ceased to exist, and I was sent. Yeah, that's right. It more or less ceased to exist, and I was then posted to the 5th Battalion, who had come from Palestine, and that was very unhappy because the adjutant of that battalion was a man I had relieved as adjutant of the 6th Battalion in these few previous months. And I didn't know anybody there. I didn't like the ones I did.
What didn't you like about? Was it?
They were commanded by somebody not in the Connaught Rangers. I can't honestly remember his name at the moment. It may be there, a man from the border regiment, and obviously the man who I'd replaced as adjutant when we were the Americans, I'd replaced him there because the then commanding officer didn't want him as adjutant and put me in instead. He was then adjutant of this lot, and I thought my future looks very uncomfortable. I didn't think, I'd never done my life before. I managed to send a telegram to the 16th Irish Division in France, saying, for God's sake, get me out of this, or words to that effect, but not quite like that.
They'd gone back to
Yes, they must. They certainly were in France, and it must have been the same lot, because the 16th Divisional staff were the same. And believe it or not, and I was still only a subaltern, they wired back and said, we will send for you on Tuesday, and there will be a motor car at the station somewhere in Belgium to bring you up to divisional headquarters. That was a turn-up for them, what do you call it, if ever there was one, because they got me out of this dreadful lot that I didn't care for at all.
Was there anything else you didn't like about the 5th Battalion? You seem to...
Well, they were a curious lot. They had been originally commanded by my uncle, who took him out to Gallipoli. And he had long since gone away from there. In fact, was in France then. But they were commanded by a man in the border regiment. They were quite a different lot. I mean, I didn't know any of them. They didn't know me. And I just felt anything but at home with them. I think they'd virtually only just come from Palestine to France.
Did they give you any job? I mean, what were you put on doing when you got there?
I suppose I was a platoon commander. I was there a very short time, I know that. But what was going to be very awkward was the man who I'd replaced as this adjutant to the training bit for the Americans was then made adjutant of that lot. Well, that wasn't going to be very funny for me, and I realised that. But I didn't know anybody there, and I'd known everybody in the old lot and all sorts of people. And so I sent this telegram off, greatly daring, expecting a thick air for it. When they ride back and said, a motor car will meet you at the station at the Godless Belt or somewhere Monday morning. And I went back and was never seen again. It was an absolute travesty of discipline and all that, but it worked.
So back to the 16th Division.
Which had come back to France with all sorts of people like the Border Regiment and so on in it. I mean, and it was no longer 16th Irish Division, but the divisional headquarters was the same.
And what job were you given?
The G3,
which was G3,
is slated to go on the Cambridge course,
and I was
put on as they nearly always had a staff learner in these places. I was put on a staff learner and very soon acting G3 of that division.
What was the G3? That was the
GSO3. There was the G1, G2, and G3, Lieutenant Colonel, Major, Captain, on the general staff side of any divisional headquarters. Well, they had those three. And the third was a chap called Muir. I didn't know it. He was going to go on the Cambridge course, which had taken him away for 8 months. And I was wanted because they knew me, and they knew that I knew the division and this, that, and the other, and how to do it. I didn't realise it. They wanted me up there to act as G3 while this other fellow was on this 8 months course. Well, he duly went on the course, and what's more, I was acting G3 of that division, which was good, clean fun. It was very much better than being sniped at in the other battalion.
And they were...
As it happened. Which, of course, is like going home again. But,
do you know what month it was that you rejoined the 16th? Approximately. Had the advances begun?
I'm just wondering, it must have been before March the 21st, because...
No, it would be after, because the division was broken up after March 21st.
Oh, it was the division, yes. Well, something happened, I don't know where, because all my kit was brought back from the front while I was away on leave or something. However...
That was the earlier...
Yes. But anyhow...
What do you remember about the advance that, as a staff officer? Firstly, perhaps, what was your job as GSO3? I mean, what did you have to do?
Well, the GSO1, who was there's always a lieutenant colonel, was the senior general staff officer. That means he dealt with operations as opposed to maintenance, rations and so on. The G2 was theoretically concerned with training, of which there was not much in France, and the G3 was normally concerned with intelligence, I mean intelligence reports and so on. But if the G2 were away, the G3 would have to be act for him and so on. And so I found working as divisional intelligence officer, which is rather a phony appointment.
Why do you say it was phony?
Well, because there's nothing in the book which says there shall be a divisional intelligence officer. But what it really meant was they invented it, and it meant there was a substitute for one of the other staff officers to go away on training or course or something. In that case, I didn't know it at the time, the G3 was slated to go on the Cambridge course, which was 8 months or 9 months, and I was slated to take over from him while he was away, and in fact did, because I'd come up there and worked with him for perhaps, I forget how long, a month.
But
acting as it's a captain's job, of course, and I was still a subaltern, but it worked all right. I enjoyed it, and good times had
what
my
What kind
all.
Of things were you doing then? Can you remember?
Nominally intelligence reports, but one went round the line to see what the troops are like, and you were sometimes taking people round the line. But in principle, you had to submit various intelligence reports to the Corps and that kind of thing, and presumably be ready to take over from the G2. Although the G2 was nominally training, obviously there was not much training done. He was presumably understudying the G1 or something, but the G3 seemed to have a little world of his own, which was quite pleasant. And one could get transport. I mean, one was about 3 or 4 miles behind the line, and you couldn't walk up there. You could take a car up part of the way and all that. Life was very pleasant, and in the sense it was interesting. And the whole idea was to coordinate, I suppose, intelligence reports. Intelligence is an unsatisfactory word. It was the official word, but keeping the Corps, army and so forth informed of what the state of affairs was like on any given part of the front at any given time. And occasionally acting for various people. I mean, on one or two occasions, I've gone out with the general to go and see what...
Who was the general at that time?
I'm just trying to think. Middlesex Regiment. It had been... Hickey was the original general of that division. Hickey was an Irish member of Parliament. And he eventually disappeared and was replaced by somebody, and I'll give you the name when he comes back.
Where were you based? I mean, what sort of accommodation was the...
Mainly it's little dugouts and huts, sometimes huts, sometimes dugouts.
And what sort of equipment, what would a headquarters contain for the officers to work with? Presumably you'd have your signals office.
Yes, there'd be a signal office and signal communication fore and aft, which was...
What sort of... Would you have what stage of sophistication had map boards reached and maps?
Oh, no, very little of that. Very little of anything sophisticated. And I try and think what the signalling side was. I think there were... Obviously, there were lines. I mean, that is telegraph and telephone wires backwards, and probably up to the brigades. I mean, the division commander could probably speak to his brigade commanders on the telephone. That's what it amounts to.
Who would keep... Would you have a map that was plotted each day, with, especially during the advance, with where everybody was?
Yes.
Who would do that? Who would actually plot the map?
Well, you probably had very good sergeant clerks and people like that who probably actually did it, possibly under the G3. I used to get out quite a lot, I know, and go around seeing what the state of affairs was like in the line and so on. Greatly depended on that. Generals occasionally did it. And there was one awful occasion when the corps commander decided to come up. Corps commanders were curious people. They were mostly very old gentlemen who were lieutenant generals. They never seemed to have any particular function at all. They were between the divisions and the army, you see. The army, in this case, was the Second Army, commanded by General Plumer. Well, General Plumer, I think, was known to practically all the soldiers in the Second Army. But whoever the corps commander was, I'm damn sure they didn't. And I've only set eyes on him once or twice, once being when the corps commander telephoned the 16th Division where I was, and I was the only chap in at the time, and said, I would like to come and see your divisional commander at 4 o'clock this afternoon, you see. I said, yes, sir, and put the telephone down. Then suddenly remembered that the divisional commander had gone up to look at the front line. And it was going to be a bit awkward if the corps commander turned up and he wasn't there. So I had to jump pretty quickly. I did get him back more or less in time. But you won't believe this. The corps commander turned up at 4 o'clock, not in a motor car or on a motorbike or anything, but with an escort of lancers with pennants and things like that flying, all on horses. It was really too funny for words. I mean, going back to the South African War, I should think. But in his mind, that was quite normal. He was the corps commander, and they never had any particular function. I've never known what a corps ever did, except pass on bump from the army to the divisions. But I managed to get the divisional commander back in time to see him, otherwise I should have been hung, drawn, and quartered. But there were curious facets of life in those days.
Did you mess together as the staff officers?
I'm just trying to think, I suppose. We did.
I'm thinking of the differences in rank.
Yes.
Was it...
It's a brigade, which was, of course, a brigade major who might be a major or a captain, and then one, two others, captains and subalterns. We all messed together, but the brigade commander for most of the time had one golden rule, that nobody must be ever late for any meal. In other words, if you were going to be late for lunch, you just didn't have lunch.
At what about at the division?
At the division, I think there were one or two messes. I mean, it was...
At different levels.
At different levels. I can't remember that. I mean, pictorially. And one tended to get out quite a lot, and going around and seeing people. Goodness knows what for, but, I mean, people are always very polite.
Now this
the only thing that was awkward is if you took... I remember taking a new G3 or somebody around the line, getting rude remarks from the officers in the line.
What sort of rude remarks?
Well, this bloke, whoever he was a real staff officer. I mean, he got red taps and so forth, and the people in the line didn't seem to like him very much. He'd obviously got the wrong attitude to going round the line, which is a thing I suppose has its own technique.
Did you have the red tabs?
No, I never got red tabs, you see, because I wouldn't have gotten them until I'd been to Cambridge and been on this course and so forth. That, and the war had to go on a bit longer for that. No, I was hoping to, but of course I know.
Did you mind the stigma that was sometimes attached to staff officers, or now is much more, in retrospect, attached to them? Did you feel any strongly about that?
Not really, because the 16th Division, both before and after March the 21st, 1918, was to some extent a family. It was to some extent a family, and the people didn't mind dealing with me as a subaltern at divisional headquarters, which they might well not have done. And there was quite a reasonable identity, if you like, between the staff officers of that division and the troops, the junior officers or the regimental officers. It wasn't always the case, but I don't mean that division. I never felt any inhibition about going to see people in the line and so forth. You tended to get known in both ways. I mean, the battalion knew you and you knew them.
Do you think the staff officer's role was important? I mean,
there were too many of them, I think. Probably.
At which level? Because you said they were a bit short of officers at brigade level. Do you mean at divisional level?
At divisional, I may be quite wrong. It's been, oh, higher, certainly. I mean, goodness knows what an army corps did. I'm blowed if I know, even to this day.
So you feel that corps staff officers were super? They were an extra layer of staff officers that wasn't necessary?
I was going to say rather stupid, if I've never seen one, but I mean, it's rather like that.
What about the army staff officers? Did you come into contact with
no,
them?
No, except the one... We were paraded somewhere at some time on a field in northern France when old Plumer, who was the army commander, came to inspect us. And I was produced as Exhibit B, as the youngest adjutant in the British Army or something for his benefit. But I'm not trying to make a point of that. But Plumer, as an army commander, would do that. He would go down and see a battalion. Very few army commanders would do that. And he was a rubicund old gentleman who looked like a fairly successful farmer, but from the troops' point of view, I'm sure he was the best army commander in France. Somehow he knew them, and he was an infantryman for a start.
Did you see that distinction? You mean as opposed to a cavalryman, do you mean?
Oh, yes. And yet...
That was a pop... I mean, you'd notice things like that, would you?
Yes, I think so, and the attitude... But there was one cavalryman who, the man who commanded the Third Army and went to Palestine, he, I think, knew the troops all right, but very few people like Gough and so forth did not. Albers, the man. He was, although a cavalryman, I think, was a very great general. In the sense that he knew...
That right up high, I mean, the Haig and people like that.
I never saw him. Full stop. How could I? I mean, in a sense. I mean, he wasn't... I don't know what he was like in South Africa, but he made his name in South Africa, I think. But you could not call him a troops general. I can't see Haig firing the troops at all, like Monty. I mean,
so, what do you remember about the advance as it went on? I mean, from when you joined and after August the 8th, there was fairly continuous advancing.
Yes, we simply went on and on. I mean, I think 10 or 15 miles a day like that.
Could you tell us the story then of how you... Because at one point you did come to order the division to advance.
Okay.
What exactly happened?
The division had been advancing, say, by 10 to 15 miles every other day. There was very little opposition. And everybody was out one day.
Where would they be when everyone was out? It sounds strange.
But by everybody, I suppose, I mean the G2 and possibly the G1. They might have been going round the line or going somewhere. And for some reason or other, it became imperative to tell the division to move 10 or 15 miles forward tomorrow. And I think that as likely as not, the divisional clerks probably told me, you better get something out, saying that we'd been going perhaps 10 miles, something like that, that they got to do something tomorrow. So I issued the order for something tomorrow, but forgot to make arrangements for the rations, which was pointed out to me when various people came back. And no doubt it pointed out to me if I'd gone any other line that time, but no uncertain way. Of course, they got their rations, but I mean, from the formal point of view, the arrangements had not been made for the rations to be delivered 15 miles further on or something like that.
You mean not at a battalion level, but with the Army Service Corps?
Yes, that's one thing, yes. I'll tell you what was interesting. On one occasion, I went up, when we were on the move like that, with the divisional commander, and we went to see what the front was like, or the moving front was like, and we crossed the frontier between France and Belgium, from France into Belgium. And the difference between the attitude of the people who we were gloriously relieving was chalk from cheese. The French were only too glad to see us. The Belgians didn't want to see us at all.
How did that show itself?
Actual sort of more or less turning their backs on you. I mean, the French would all come out. Here's an English general coming up or something like that, and people would turn out and say Banzai or something of that kind. The Belgians were sullen. They got on very well with the Germans, that's why. You can't altogether blame them, but I mean, they were having a fairly comfortable time. And by that, I mean the people fairly near the front. Because this became apparent as soon as you crossed over the national boundary, which happened at that time to be more or less the military boundary. But it was quite obvious. I mean, they immediately came up and kicked up a shindy with the general about mines being exploded at crossroads and they couldn't take their carts along and so forth. Anyway, there was a quite different attitude from the part of the Belgians.
Now, you were considering going into the full-time into the staff at this time. You were wanting to go to Cambridge.
I can assure you, I was having a... Remember, I was only what? This is what year? This is 1918.
You'd be 20.
Add to the year. I was only 20. I wasn't really thinking of the future at all. I was having a very interesting time. But, of course, in fact, other people were, in effect, mapping out a military career for me. I mean, they, no doubt they thought that, or didn't. But I was not aware of it. I didn't really grasp this Cambridge course business until the other chap had gone away. I was simply interested in day-to-day existence. I think all of us were. And it was very interesting, of course. I was having a pretty interesting time compared with sloping arms all day.
I believe there was a circular at some time about staff officers. I mean, could you just explain what happened? It's quite an interesting story.
What, that one about the... Oh, I don't remember that specifically, except that there was such a thing as a circular came around. One saw a lot of circulars, and I can remember that one fairly setting me on edge, because in those
what
days...
What was it that set you on an edge?
Well, if possible, with private means.
The circular said that?
Oh, yes, the circular said that. And like most sons of parsons and so on, I had no private means, but I considered I was... reasonable material for being a staff officer, as one would be now, but it struck one as being a very retrograde thing to put down when there must have been lots of capable people who had not got private means.
And this actually happened during the war, this?
Evidently.
Right.
You see, it certainly happened sometime in 1918.
Another amusing incident was when the divisional commander was locked in the lavatory. Could you tell us that story?
It's quite simple. I mean, towards the end of the war, for the last month or so, we were hopping eastwards from country house to country house because the division was moving at about 10 to 15 miles a day, and the divisional headquarters went from one country house to another if we could find them. It was the quickest way of setting up a headquarters, of course. And that actually happened. The divisional commander went to the lavatory and the handles had all been taken off because they were brass and the Germans had wanted the metal. And he couldn't get out. But fortunately, I'm the sort of person who goes about, look at this drawer with all sorts of implements and so on. Well, it wasn't this, but I'll tell you a bit of history about that. But something like this could go into the square hole that the handle of a door would go into, you see, to turn that. I managed to put that in and turn the handle, you see. The handles had been taken off because they were brass. No, this is an aspect of regimental language, rather odd. This was part of a custom that if people went to stay the night with a regiment in other days, I mean sort of pre-South African War perhaps, it was customary to give a little present to the regiment. Here you can hardly see it, but there's 88 Connaught Rangers engraved on that, and that was given to the mess of the Connaught Rangers by two priests who was put up for the weekend or something. They felt they were bound to give something, so they very kindly gave that.
The paper knife.
It's a paper knife, and I use it very much as a paper knife now. But that's, by the way...
So, are there anything else you remember about your time as a staff officer before? Because you caught flu whilst on leave, and you actually were at home during the armistice. Do you remember any other instance before that happened?
Before that happened? No, only that I was finding life very interesting. I mean, as I say, for instance, when the divisional commander wanted to go and look at the front, now the front was moving, to go out with him and see this move from France into Belgium and so on, things like that. I have absolutely no idea what happened behind the divisional front. I never went to a corps headquarters or anything like that and didn't care very much. But I think what was very satisfying was, as a subaltern, wherever you were, as a rule, in a battalion or the equivalent, you would not know much about the military machine as a whole. At a divisional headquarters, you really got a good idea of it. and you were interested in it. And I think that's it. It was very interesting to see how the machine worked and in a way, the sort of power it had.
And October, you went home on leave and caught the Spanish...
Like everybody else, they caught flu, you see, because the flu was going all over Europe at that
time.
How
bad was it, the flu? Because it killed a lot of people.
I think it was always bad, but fortunately, to my mother's alarm, the family doctor said, you better let him have rum, because he's been drinking rum every night for the last 2 or 3 years, and it'll probably make him better. And that's exactly what happened. One had, quite true, been used to a rum ration. He only drank one tot of rum every night. And my mother, to her, was very distressed at this, but concurred and did it, and I got better quite quickly. And then, to my horror, I couldn't go back to the front. Among other things, the war had ended, but I still wanted to go back.
Do you remember the day that war, November the 11th, the armistice?
Oh, yes, at home, of course.
What do you remember of it?
That there'll never be another day like this. I mean, there'll never be another war like this.
You thought that at the time?
I can remember quite consciously thinking that.
And were you relieved, or how did you feel in yourself about that?
Well, I was very sorry for all the friends one had lost. I mean, that's quite true, because a lot of us, I mean, we were a generation, you see, and a great proportion of us had been killed. Take any school record or anything like that. You realise it isn't very much in percentages. It may be 10% or something like that. But it is a great deal, personally, of lost people. And one very soon found that one had missed a generation or something. People had grown up while you, in a way, were standing still.
And that thought that came to you at the time of the armistice?
At the time of the armistice, the overriding thing was, this will never happen again. I can remember that quite consciously, thinking that. And then going down to Oxford and going down to a medical board and telling a lot of old gentlemen there, and how long have you been away, my boy? I said, about 2 years. And they all collapsed and gave me 2 months' leave, which was a bonus.